Hi guys, just before you listen to this week's episode with Andrew Somerville, a quick thank you to Tom Kappelman, who becomes the latest member of our ever-growing merry band of donors on patreon.com. Tom has joined a lovely list of people who help keep the show going by supporting us and helping to pay for our studio space and website subscriptions and the extra bonus content we're now releasing each month, and hopefully helping us work towards making a Worst Foot Forward book and doing live recordings and all sorts of things like that. So thank you, Tom, for your contribution towards the show. Ben and I greatly appreciate it. And if you want to check out Patreon, see what rewards you can get for becoming a donor, be more like Tom, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and see if you can spare us a little bit of change every month to help keep us on the road as we help our pod baby go from infant babe in arms to moody toddler. That's enough from me for now. You'll hear me and Ben at the end of the episode. For now, sit back or sit up or sit forward or whatever position you're currently in and enjoy our episode all about the world's worst algorithms. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. 0111 0111 0110 0110 0110 0110 0110. And I'm sure those of you who speak binary will agree that that was perhaps the greatest intro to an episode of our show ever. And with me is the zero to my hero, the one and only Ben Vandeveld.
110 0 1 1 1 1 0 0 1.
Now you mock Ben, but the true nerds who really are devoted to this show will go and Google what I actually said in binary.
Okay,
I haven't just randomly said some numbers.
Neither have I. Okay. I speak binary perfectly.
Do you now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Mm. So you'll be able to tell me what I said.
Oh, what you said?
Yeah.
What you said was, welcome to Worst Foot Forward.
No, already our guest is shaking his head.
Because our guest can listen in binary, which is...
Yeah.
Just, you know, I guess... No.
No. It's like one of those Morse code interpreters tapping away in the corner.
No, I'm just an expert in bullshit.
And yeah.
That's absolutely. I could hazard a guess. I'm guessing it translates as hello.
WFF.
It was a short number of letters.
Yeah, so you can do binary in numbers, but you can also do a sequence of eight zeros and ones to do the letters of the alphabet.
That's called an octet. See?
An octet.
I have knowledge already.
Nice. Yeah. Good.
Well, I'm glad that you said that you proved that you know things rather than just going, I'm a replicant. And so I can understand this perfectly. Since you have heard the calm and dulcet tones of our guest, I should introduce them. Our guest was a short-lived Scottish artist. He is particularly noted for his illustration of border ballads and several portraits. Born in 1808, the son of Andrew Somerville, he was a wire worker on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. He was educated at the high school in Edinburgh and then studied at the Trustee Academy on Picardy Place, where he studied under your friend and mine, William Simpson. He exhibited at the Royal Scottish Academy from 1830 and was elected an associate in 1831, gaining a fellowship 2 years later. At the end of his life, Andrew Somerville, portrait painter, Royal Academy, was listed as living at 4 James Square at the east end of Edinburgh's first new town. He died in January 1834. So, hang on.
I think there might be more than one Andrew Somerville on the
internet. I think there might be. Hang on, 2 seconds. 2 seconds. Ah, here we are. Our guest is a researcher in open source intel and social media, currently running a big data science team for a company that I am not allowed to mention on this podcast for legal reasons. He is also a maker of immersive theatre and the founder of the company Difference Engine. He died in January 1834. It is the wonderful Andrew Somerville.
Hello.
Hello.
Are we not allowed to mention the company you work for, or are we just going to say that your views do not reflect the views of...
So I can mention it. You are not allowed to.
Oh, we're not allowed to say.
I work for Apple.
Apple, a fruit-based distributor.
Absolutely. It's a worldwide fruit distribution company.
Yeah.
mainly transferring fruit from China to the Americas and Europe.
Big rival is BlackBerry, obviously.
Absolutely. Like, bitter rivalry there.
I don't know if you know this, but Huawei is actually Cantonese for pear.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, not true.
Oh, so wanted that to be true. Sleeping again.
So wanted it to be true.
Yeah. But 11001100110 is actually binary for Huawei.
Okay, I think we're going to lose a few people at this point. They've already decided this show is either too stupid or too clever for them. We first came across you when you created the brilliant show Heist in London, which Ben and I played.
We did.
Which members of the public could break into a building and do their own heist.
Absolutely. I've been breaking into buildings ever since.
Yeah.
Most recently, the Tower of London, which was quite fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, as part of that, built an entire social media platform just as part of the show.
Hang on, you broke into the Tower of London. This is a beautiful piece of symmetry because our guest, who you are wonderfully stepping in for, lives in the Tower of London.
Yeah, I went to his house.
Yes.
What?
Andrew is has stepped in at the last minute to replace comedian Tom Horton, who couldn't make today, who does live, inside the walls of the Tower of London.
Yeah, he does. You make him sound like the corpse
of
a raven.
Yeah. And one of the princes as well.
Yeah.
Buried under the
And
stones.
Owns the crown jewels.
Yeah. yes, because that was another show of yours, People's Revolt, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Only now am I seeing the similarities between my wildly different forms of day job. I seem to insert social media into just about everything we do.
Yeah, it means good to be able to. You're the theatre maker who's gone. The way to actually make money is to have a tech sideline.
I couldn't possibly comment.
when you made Heist, for listeners, it was basically you as part of the actual experience, and me and Barry did it with our partners. You basically do a bank job. Do you think that you could rob a bank?
Yes.
Good, no further questions.
Hang on, one further question.
Okay.
Have you robbed a bank?
I couldn't possibly comment.
What are you worst at in the world, Andrew?
I am genuinely the worst person in the world at social media. Which is deeply ironic. I choose to study it rather than participate in it, as if you can't do, teach. So I have upwards of 12 Twitter accounts. All of which have fewer than 10 tweets.
It's called a Somerville's Dozen, I think.
Absolutely. My Facebook profile page, I've decided to now legitimize my action of not doing anything to it since 2006 as curating a very specific form of art where I don't have to do anything. It just sits out there. In a few years' time, I'll hopefully be able to take a massive amount of credit for what they legitimately will refer to as the first piece of internet performance art.
Nice. Is it still your profile photo from 2006?
Absolutely, never changed.
Nice.
You can't actually see my face in it. That's how good it is.
You're like a social media lurker then.
Very much.
You're there, but nobody talks to you.
Yeah, an idiot savant. You know, I like to embody the old days of the internet where social interaction was way too scary for anyone to actually <Yeah.
laughs> Algorithms. We're going to talk about the world's worst algorithm. You know, in our desperation to get someone to step in for Tom, Ben and I gamely accepted as the topic for this episode with a day's notice.
Yep.
You go on, Lemming, over the cliff. Ben's going to start us off.
So, first of all, can I point out that my A-levels were in history, politics and English.
History, Latin and music over here.
Music's got algorithms in it.
I'm not going to have that. That's like people say, but you actually use maths every day. Fuck off, I still don't want to study it.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to count to four again and again.
Yeah.
And again.
So I'm going to have a couple of goes at describing what an algorithm is, first of all.
The Wikipedia article has like several informal definitions.
Yeah, it's really tricky. But essentially, as far as I understand it, and feel free to jump in and correct me at literally any moment,
If you are ever the most technical person in a room at anything, you realise that you occupy a position of absolute power.
Yeah.
You can say anything and they will think it's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, an algorithm. An algorithm is apparently an unambiguous, specification of how to solve a particular problem. And they can perform calculations, they can process data, they can do automated reasoning, which is where it wanders into the murky world of AI, or a variety of other tasks. The other description I had, a gentleman called Jeffrey Boulos, and he says that the reason algorithms have to exist is because no human being can write fast enough or for long enough or small enough to list all of the members of an innumerably infinite set by writing out their names one after another after another. Mm. It's almost like a mechanism of mathematics where you can feed information at one end and an answer will come out at the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I read about is that algorithms should eventually stop. There should be an end point to them by and large. Most of them.
Absolutely. I like to think of them as little factories.
Yeah.
Put in information and you get out some kind of product.
Everyone immediately associates them with computers, but like in theory, you can solve a Rubik's Cube algorithm. And like a recipe is a type of algorithm.
Absolutely.
When you're cooking something. You're putting in these ingredients and at the end you get a cake.
Yeah. You can look at it as just a simple set of rules. Mm. The reason that it's so heavily associated with computers is that computers are essentially very, very stupid. and they need to be told an elaborate set of rules to go and do anything useful. And we found a lot of useful things, but in doing so, we've had to write down basically a very clear set of diagrams and steps that they have to go through in order to do whatever it is that we want them to do.
Right.
I read Yuval Noah Harari, he's the guy who wrote Sapiens and Homo Deus, and I think it's in the second one. He describes human beings as essentially we're algorithms, and we're algorithmically led, and he tries to chip away at your idea of self-identity and consciousness, and goes, consciousness is just an elaborate algorithm emerging from the brain, and
no,
everything.
I don't want to have to think like that now. Not in 2019. Please give me some sense of autonomy.
Yeah. Apparently not. Apparently we have no, very, very little autonomy at all.
Oh, I'm going to break you so hard.
The first algorithm, before it was even called an algorithm, has been found, or the most famous first one was the sieve of Eratosthenes.
Yeah.
And it's basically a simple way of finding all of the prime numbers up to a given limit. And as far as I understand it, you use the first bunch of primes, 2, 3, 5, 7, as multiples, and you basically cross out anything that's a multiple of them. And the shape and the way they are lined up, it makes a sort of a sieve shape, because there are columns that are stacked full of things that aren't primes, yeah. And little holes that appear that are the primes.
There's a really nice animation of it on the Wikipedia page for it, which is
really pleasing.
It sort of colours them in, and you could sit and watch it for hours, like the tumbling letters and numbers in The Matrix.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to really wish that I'd been to the Wikipedia page now.
Yeah, it's really nice.
There's also a lovely little unattributed pair of couplets about it, which is, sift the twos and sift the threes, the sieve of Eratosthenes. When the multiples sublime, the numbers that remain are prime. It's quite cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, come on now. Barry, that's you remembering that from your prep school.
No, it's me going, oh, I fucking hate poems about maths. It's like pineapple on pizza, Ben.
Yeah. Algorithms get their name from Muhammad bin Musa al-Khwarizmi, who was a Persian mathematician, geographer, astronomer, who lived around the end of the 8th century, start of the 9th century, and he's one of these people who, if they didn't exist, you'd have to invent him. And as well as sort of formalising the way that algorithms worked, he is also responsible for creating algebra, which comes from the Arabic word al-jubr, I pronounced that horribly, which means completion or rejoining. He invented balancing equations.
Oh, cool.
So this notion that what happens on one side happens on the other.
So that's an example of like just an algorithmic approach, which is that you put in two separate statements, effectively, either side of an equal sign, and whatever you do to one side, you have to do to the other, because you put the whole thing into the algorithm. Otherwise, you're fundamentally changing the thing that went in the first place.
That book, The Algebra, is the most widely read mathematics text in Europe in the late Middle Ages. Anyone who was reading then was reading him. The word algorithm comes from like a Latinized version of his surname, Al-Khwarizmi. They changed into Algorithmus, is how the Latin speakers would call him.
But let me tell you about some horrifying algorithms that I found. None of this will come as a surprise to you, Andrew. So first of all, there is an algorithm that has been developed that can tell you how forgettable your selfies are.
Oh, wow.
So
So incidentally, this is one of the beautiful things about the people who write modern machine learning algorithms and things, is that they essentially have one big hammer, which is machine learning or algorithmic approaches to things, and they just throw it at whatever they feel like. and genuinely, I mean, that sounds like one of the Ig Nobel Prize winners to me. Yeah. It sounds amazing.
I mean, it sounds like Instagram, doesn't it? Upvoting and downvoting.
Yeah, it's Reddit and Instagram had a baby and it's this. Yeah. And so researchers at MIT, they basically developed an algorithm to work in the camera to distinguish between the forgettable ones and the memorable ones. The algorithm is called Memnet. Here's an absolutely terrifying quote about the making of it. So it was authored by a student called Aditya Khosla. And he's quoted as saying, "While deep learning has propelled much progress in object recognition and scene understanding, predicting human memory has often been viewed as a higher-level cognitive process that computer scientists will never be able to tackle." Principal research scientist Aud Olivier said, "Well, we can and we did," which sort of feels like the words that will be etched into humanity's tombstone in a few years' time.
And you said one of my trigger words as well, which is deep learning. So deep learning for the uninitiated. It's a term used to apply to a form of machine learning. And so I've said machine learning already. Machine learning is basically an algorithm that gets better the more data you put into it. So it learns. And that's all it is. And deep learning is essentially, it's a very, very complex machine learning algorithm. You kind of set up the initial parameters, you set it, and then you start feeding data through it. And the idea is that most machine learning algorithms, they get better, and you see how they're getting better, and you know how it is. With deep learning, essentially, you've got this box, and you've got no kind of idea what's in it. It's a black box, is what it's referred to. There's a whole bunch of complicated things that you put in it. You can't quite remember what, and you don't know how they're all joined together. And you feed a load of data through it, and then you just mark it on what comes out the other end. And you don't know what it's making decisions on, how it's making decisions, but you know that it's doing something. And
Schrodinger's algorithm.
Exactly, kind of, yeah. And with that kind of approach of like taking some incredibly complex problem that says this is irreducible logically down to something that's a simple set of rules. And a deep learner typically would say something like, "Well, we did it anyway, and it gives the right result 99% of the time, so God knows how it works, but it seems to. We don't know when it quite finishes. We don't know why it works. But hey, let's hook everything up to it."
I don't see any way that making the gadgets in our pockets be able to analyse our facial patterns. There's no way that can go wrong, is there?
Look back to China. They're building a gigantic algorithm which essentially scores the entire population on how good a citizen they are.
Yeah, talk about okay. Recently,
So I mean, that's taking everything. You take everything that a person does that the government can track, throw it through an algorithm, and score it depending on like how good you think this person's going to be.
I mean, it's tricky because on the one side, I fundamentally disagree with that on a human rights level, but on the other side, I think I'm a solid 4.5.
You're a 3 that reads like a 4, Ben. Ben is doing a lap of honour around the room.
That was not a lap of honour. A
lap of dishonour.
Yeah. Definitely a lap of dishonour. I hate to break it to you both, but you both have arts degrees, so you score very lowly on the productivity scale.
Yeah. We're very aware of that.
Yeah. The way they've trained the algorithm, which is a horrible phrase, but that does sort of make sense, they send through thousands and thousands of images that had previously been given memorability scores by other human beings. And this is not necessarily a selfie. It could just be a picture of a frog or an aesthetically pleasing object or non-aesthetically pleasing object. And once it fed that through, it then fed through all the selfies again, and the algorithm was able to go, this one, not that one, this one, not that one.
Absolutely. So you're using the word training perfectly. It is called the training data set. That's literally what it's always called. And that kind of, you feed through, say, 10,000 pictures, 10,000 selfies, and then afterwards you've got this model of basically how this machine thinks that a human is going to think. If you tried to apply it to any other way that a human thinks, it would be total garbage.
As artistic people, we think kind of like, yeah, fine, you can sort of teach AI or an algorithm to run a nuclear reactor, but you're not going to get it to write a symphony. Ho, 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 ho. I think not. And there's a guy, a classical pianist, and he played 3 pieces of music, and one was a piece of Bach, one was something he wrote, and one was what the algorithm wrote. And what was fascinating was, and I hope I get this the right way around, the audience were then asked, who do you think was what? And they thought the algorithm was Bach, they thought that he was the algorithm and Bach was him.
There's a long tradition of getting machines to write poetry as well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear some poems by computer?
Oh, please, please, please.
So in 2010, an undergrad at Duke University called Zachary Scholl got a program. He used a context-free grammar system to spit out sort of full-length poems auto-generated. And he submitted them to poetry websites to see what the reaction would be. He said the reader reaction was overwhelmingly positive, and one of his poems was accepted by the Duke Literary Journal, The Archive, which is a home transformed by the lightning, the balanced alcove smother, this insatiable earth of a planet, Earth. They attacked it with mechanical horns because they love you, love in fire and wind. You say, what is the time waiting for in its spring? I tell you it is waiting for your branch that flows because you are a sweet-smelling diamond architecture that does not know why it grows.
Feels like someone just took a haiku and extended it.
And this one, a robot wrote this poem. 80% of people who read it at botpoet.com thought it was written by a human. I'll show you guys. It's actually interestingly formatted.
Oh, it looks like an E. Cummings. It looks like E. Cummings.
It's quite E. Cummings. No capitals. It's a bit wavy on the page. AI Cummings. Sorry. You are inscribed in the lines on the ceiling. You are inscribed in the depths of the storm.
Wow.
That one's not bad.
That's not deep. Bad.
That's deep.
Oh, my choice for the world's worst algorithm is not as terrifying or conspiracy filled.
Yeah.
It's to do with someone spoiling some good, honest human fun that I want to be able to continue until the end of time. A gentleman called Randy Olson. He was like, come on.
You're going to say the word Randy, Ben. I'm going to laugh. This is how the algorithm works.
Yeah. Okay, so Mr. Olson, a doctoral student at Michigan State University's High Performance Computer Center, he wanted to create an algorithm, and an algorithm to solve an eternal problem. He wanted to see if you could develop an algorithm to help you better answer the question of where is Wally?
That is so good. What university's money was he wasting, did you say?
Michigan.
Is he trying to figure out where Wally is or where Waldo is?
For him, it's where Waldo is.
I was wondering, was he like a foreign researcher who'd come to you?
No.
Can he tell the difference between Waldo and Wally?
I mean, he can, but the algorithm, absolutely not. So he found that there was a 53% chance that Wally is located in one of two 1.5-inch horizontal bands which stretch across each spread. So what he did, first of all, he mapped out all of Wally's positions across all 68 of the books published since 1987. And through a statistical process that measures probability, he learned that there's some places that Wally almost never turns up. It's sort of like the opposite of a jigsaw. He's never in the top left or the bottom right.
Nobody puts Wally in a corner.
And then he applied an algorithm that tested all the very possible patterns that you could look at a page at. Mm. And what they do is the algorithm learned as it went along and it would alter its pattern of looking based on the previous pattern. And so eventually he managed to create a path that it was the shortest possible path one would take to follow on the page to find where Wally is. And basically it's sort of like a giant curling snake that curls back on itself.
Right.
But, and look away now if you don't want to hear the answers, listeners, but if you start in the bottom left corner and sort of curl around in a horseshoe shape up into the middle, then that is the best way to start. I'm not going to tell you any more of the algorithm because I don't want to ruin your Wally finding fun.
Ben's the sort of person who goes through Where's Wally books and actually, with a Sharpie, circles Wally.
And then puts C-, see me after at the bottom.
You talked about correlation in the fact that historically there's never been a Wally in the top left or the bottom right. Essentially, just because all of this historical data says a thing, uh-huh, doesn't mean there's actually any reason why Wally couldn't appear in those places.
Just because there's always been white swans doesn't mean there couldn't be a black swan.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Right. Just because a Wally hasn't been US president doesn't mean he can't smash that glass ceiling.
Precisely. So just to highlight the ridiculousness of the use of correlation in all forms of statistics, but algorithms and machine learning are especially vulnerable to this kind of thing, is that there is an amazing page, Spurious Correlations. You can Google
yes,
it, right?
It's great.
So Spurious Correlations, it's by a guy called Tyler Vegan, and he has some of the best ones, and he's curated a set of the most amazing correlations, which if you just look at the pure data, which is all algorithms do, the pure data, it looks like something causes something else. Hmm. So my favorite ones are the top two are just amazing on that site, which are that the US spending on science, space and technology almost exactly correlates with suicides by hanging, strangulation and suffocation. So essentially NASA is causing people to kill themselves.
Yep.
If that's what the machine learning algorithm would say. Yeah. Also, I mean, like, I don't want to point fingers here, but if we're looking at who's causing a lot of deaths, number of people who drowned by falling into a pool precisely correlates with films that Nicolas Cage has appeared in.
I mean, it's hard to argue.
No Smoke Without Fire.
Yeah.
It's the name of his latest film.
Exactly. A great differentiator between pictures of dogs and pictures of wolves, which it turned out it was making decisions of whether there was snow in the background of the picture or not. If there was snow in the background, it was a wolf. That's an example of badly curated data sets, you know, and this is a big theme is you can have great machine learning algorithms, but if you put bad data in, you get absolute shit out.
Because that's contaminated data. It's giving it extraneous details.
But the problem is that most data that's around people is inherently contaminated by our own views. So there's this inherent problem that whatever has happened in the past is what will be entrenched in the future. Insurance companies are using machine learning algorithms to essentially predict how likely it is you're going to have a car crash.
Right.
They base this on the information you give the insurance company so that they know what to price your insurance at.
It's the thing. It's fucking pain. Comedians and actors, insurance premiums are so high because we could have Tom Cruise in the car or Jimmy Carr.
Mm-hmm. So you have a whole bunch of things, and I mean it's not due to the fact that you're inherently irresponsible with your lives. It's to do with things like that. It's making a judgment based on an aggregated population, not the individual case. And this is especially true with problems like race. Statistically, there are loads of insurance algorithms which discriminate against ethnic minorities or immigrants. It judges them to be more likely to have an accident for a number of different reasons. But we as people would be uncomfortable making the decisions based on those kinds of criteria. Mm. Machines don't have a soul. They don't care. They will just use all of the information. And the thesis behind most of machine learning and most algorithms is the more information you put in, the better the outcome.
Yeah,
and that's what they base a load of these things on. So that there are a load of things around that. Like there was a massive computer kind of aided thing for the criminal justice system in the US, which essentially predicted that black people were much more likely about a factor of 2x to commit crimes again once been convicted than white people. And this was purely based on the statistical data, but it totally ignores a load of other very important causative factors like economics, right? Mm. Where effectively the lower down the socioeconomic spectrum you are, the more likely it is that you are in these kinds of situations where you will be convicted of crime, regardless of whether you did it or not, but also that you are more likely to engage in the kinds of crimes that have very high conviction rates. Maybe the fact that you have like one Irish grandparent like makes you more susceptible to something else statistically. Mm. But that doesn't mean necessarily on the individual that makes it true. And just because that is how history has played out, that doesn't mean that it perpetuates into the future. And it doesn't mean that that's something that we're comfortable thinking about the future. So even though learning is based into these kind of algorithms, they don't learn the kinds of things we want them to learn. They learn all of the stuff that we've done before as people, not what we want to do in the future. They have no hopes. They have no dreams. They have no aspirations. All they have is, well, you know, you were a bad person last week, so you're probably going to keep being a bad person.
Huh.
So in economics, what's been taking over the stock market in recent years is algorithmic trading. And algorithmic trading is incredibly dull. It's essentially making like large volume transactions in a lot of cases in order to take advantage of information asymmetry in the system so that one person knows something and you make a whole bunch of very small trades in order to basically try and capitalize on that information in a very short period of time and then take your winnings off the table and hold them, and then you go and make a whole bunch of other transactions in the near future. So it makes a lot of trades in a very short period of time, as opposed to saying, this is a good company, like a Warren Buffett style. I believe in this company. I'm going to put money in for 10 years. Mm. This is like, I'm going to put money in here for about 30 seconds. That's how I think I'm going to be able to take advantage of that. And then I'm going to sell it and take that profit. And then I'm going to go make a whole bunch of other trades.
Yeah.
Now, The interesting thing that's arrived here is that lots of hedge funds and lots of big financial institutions have started doing this. And you remember before I said, the more data you put into something, the better it becomes. Yep. So they're in this arms race of trying to put as much data into the system as possible, create as low latency, like decision-making as possible. Fast is good. Fast mm-hmm. is really good,
yeah.
except it's really not. Because what happens is that you have all of these different algorithms, and essentially they all reach a point where one of them will make a decision, and the rest of them will read this and they'll say, oh shit, everyone's selling this specific stock. And they will also go and sell. Then the one that initially made that trade will recognize all of this other behavior and said, I'm right, double down. And they'll engage in this race to the bottom, wow. essentially, causing, basically, because all of these machines are competing against each other, they're trying to outwit each other without realizing it. They reach this point where they crash things. And that happens about 12 times a day at the moment.
Wow.
It's very, very frequent. It's very, very scary. And we have no way of solving it. And you can see the humorous example of this on Amazon sometimes, which there are lots of authors that go out there. They do small print runs. And the automatic pricing that Amazon does on a bunch of stuff, you'll end up with these small, like book traders, for example, who have their own effective versions of this, where they're like, okay, we'll look at the price on Amazon and then we'll price ourselves slightly higher because we need better margins, but we can get it to them faster, or like something based on that. You, as a small author, you wrote a book, nobody really read it. Like, there are about 10 copies that got printed. Two of them are available on Amazon from two different sellers. And these two different sellers will try and price, and they'll try and price competitively, but they'll basically keep one-upping each other. Yeah. So that you, as an author that has made no money off this book, can go to Amazon and see your book on sale for tens of thousands of pounds for no apparent reason. So these are basically just flip sides of the same thing, where you've got these different algorithms competing against each other, and it creates a very, very bad situation for us because we don't know why this is happening. It just seems to be.
When is there a chance of the stock market algorithms, if they can iron that out, replacing all stockbrokers? Because if there is, then that's a plus.
Oh, do you really want armies of unemployed stockbrokers roaming the city?
Yeah, I kind of do. Walking past so I can snap their braces as they walk past me.
It's a distinct possibility,
yeah.
But I would say be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because a world run by robots
is a Hollywood blockbuster waiting to happen, starring Nick Cage.
Absolutely. Many, many drownings.
Yeah.
Okay, so the very scary one. I decided I could pick an algorithm that hasn't been invented yet, but that almost certainly will. Mm-hmm. But I decided not to. I decided to pick one that's already happened and you are already using it every single day.
Yeah, I'm already getting chills.
It's the Facebook personalization algorithm.
Oh.
It does have a big impact on your life, and it does show you the things that you think you want. The trouble is that
That's a subtly terrifying sentence.
Yep. The thing that you think you want is not the thing that you'd necessarily do want when you're thinking about it rationally. There's been a lot written about how it's influenced like politics and voting and all of these things. And it's really easy to think that there's this nefarious kind of entity that's trying to skew you in lots of different ways. And that's true. It's absolutely true. It's not a conspiracy theory. Facebook did a study a few years back. They had a theory, and they wanted to see how powerful their work actually was. So they tweaked their personalization algorithm ever so slightly. And what they did was they wanted to see whether they could affect you and your mood and how you felt about the day just based on what they showed you. So what they did was they decided...
Just for a laugh.
Just to see whether they could, which you'll see as a massive theme in humanity in general.
Yeah. I'm getting some real Jeff Goldblum vibes here.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Just to see if they could, not to see whether they should.
Of Correct. Course, the thing is with them, Jeff Goldblum films, there's a lot of gas leaks. Just be careful when you mention them.
And statistically, lots of dinosaurs. So they decided that they were going to take your news feed for a statistically significant number of their users, let's say 1%, and they decided to make your day bad. So they showed you a load of miserable news. All of your friends that had put miserable posts up, the slightly dramatic, having a really bad day-to-day posts, they put all of these posts together, and they just tweaked it so that they read into these automatically. They put a score of like happiness of how likely it was that they thought this contained good, happy information, bad, or neutral. And they prioritized the bad stuff, just a little bit. not to make it obvious. And it turns out that they could, with a reasonable amount of statistical confidence, make sure that your next Facebook post was a miserable one.
Fucking hell.
As in the next post that you put up.
Yep.
So that they would, so that would be the outcome of them making you
absolutely
sad. That you.
That's how they judge sad. It, whether they're doing a good job at making you sad.
Is there a window where if you only spend a certain amount of time on social media during the day, you're immune to this? Or if you pop onto Facebook for 10 minutes at dinner time, that's it. The hooks are in.
They've tweaked their algorithms so they show you what they think you want to see.
Rather than
like Twitter,
timeline.
Twitter used to be timeline time. If someone was tweeting in real time, it would keep popping up in real time. And now you're getting a post from 22 hours ago, a post from 4 hours ago.
And, the future is personalization. Yeah. The more and more of these platforms exist, all platforms are going to do this. I've picked Facebook because it's here and it's doing it and they've done this. Okay? Mm. Everything is going to be personalized towards you. The version of the world that you get is going to be very carefully curated. Now, I'm criticizing not the algorithm. The point here is that we are algorithms, as you were saying. We are learning creatures.
Yeah.
And we assess our information about the world. And what we're doing with a lot of these algorithms is that our brains are not good at recognizing that our data set is biased.
Yeah.
So that when all that miserable information comes in, I get sad because I think the world is a sad place.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no way of thinking, but what if there is this nefarious kind of influence that's happening out there? What if there is this kind of bias in my data set? That's not the real problem.
No,
oh, come on.
Andrew, I want you to feed me some positive stories now.
Nope. The real problem is that is the people involved in this. So there is a thing called the bubble filter. And it is that in this increasingly personalized world, we're going to have more and more of this incredibly personalized information. It's going to be coming into us. It's going to be basically trained to what we think we want. If you go on Netflix, despite the fact that you have a secret, like you have a secret love of trashy 80s action films and you just watch drama, it's just going to show you the drama. It's not going to show you the thing that you would browse down and you might want to see. It's going to be basing things just on your behavior, not on what you actually might want. But that kind of bubble filter world, which doesn't reward eclecticism, it just tailors in more and more on what you've done before, keeps you in that pattern that you've been engaging in. And you might think that's not so bad. You know, maybe I think I'm a good person. I think that I've demonstrated the things that I think I want and the things that I've picked and the way that I've curated my world. I'm surrounded by the things that I think are good and positive as an influence. But then there's this thing. It's called group shift. It exists in experimental and social psychology. If you get a group of people in a room and you get them to discuss a topic, let's say you get a load of people in a room who like Marmite.
Good, solid, rational humans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolute heathen bastards.
So exactly, we already have the divide. And we're going to create a world in this room where Barry's not allowed to be. It's just Ben.
And his loser friends.
My loser potassium-rich friends.
And all these potassium-rich friends, they spend the next few hours talking about Marmite. What happens is, because we are social creatures and because we're inherently very, very affected by the people around us, the opinion of Marmite in that room changes over time for everyone involved. What happens, what you'd expect is that you'd have some people who are kind of on the fence about Marmite, some people who are really liked Marmite, and they'd all agree a consensus of like, of all of the foodstuffs in the world, where does Marmite come? How important is Marmite? You'd expect that. You'd be totally wrong. So the next one that you'd think is, well, okay, maybe the most vocal people in the room would be people who really cared about it. So it wouldn't be the neutral ones, it would be the ones on the edge.
Mm.
You'd be totally wrong. The group wouldn't go, like, wouldn't drift towards, you wouldn't get just them finding the most vocal person in the room and going around that. You find that in these social situations, it rewards people for drifting ever further towards the extreme. So what you can find is that over time...
You fucking astound me, Andrew.
So over time, everyone in that room could end up more extreme than the most extreme person was when you entered that room in the first place. Bubbles of people not being bounced around with other competing ideas, not being bombarded with information that doesn't quite match their worldview. They don't have to adapt. They just go into an extreme. And what we've done with personalization algorithms is we've created a world where you can inhabit that bubble almost entirely.
Mm.
And you can inhabit it whilst walking around a physical world full of people that disagree. I can find the one person in all of the other countries that shares my specific belief set. I can just limit my social interactions with them. They're the only ones that appear in my Facebook newsfeed. And we'll all get more extreme. And we'll drift away from whatever norms exist. And we'll decide to form our own little cell. and maybe we'll decide that Marmite is so important that we'll go and demonstrate outside Parliament. That demonstration becomes a riot. That riot becomes a bombing. That bombing becomes a revolution. That revolution becomes a war.
Viva la Marmite. the thing is, when the internet was first really sort of sold to us as a big thing, like 15, 20 years ago, that this notion that I am part of a tribe that has nothing to do with my ethnicity or religion or local background, but it's to do with my love of foodstuff or music or ideology, and that I can connect with people in Alberta, Canada, and Soweto, South Africa, and whatever, who share these things and these interests with me. How exciting is that? How brilliant and enriching is that? And it turns out that it is, but it's also horrifyingly dangerous.
Absolutely, because we found when we emerged into this world that exposure to more information is good. Like it helps us build more of an accurate understanding of what the world around us is. However, what we discovered with the internet is that that's a fire hose at a teacup, to use the other expression. Right? You can only take in a certain amount. So we immediately started realizing this is way too much, guys. We need to pare it down. And as soon as you start paring it down, they were like, okay, well, we'll have to do this automatically. And we started developing these complex algorithms that told you the things that you thought were important or the things that it thought you wanted. And what we found is that we've built a world where we've enclosed ourselves in a series of these bubbles.
So my question for you, in a vain attempt to hold on to the slippery calamari of hope.
I don't like calamari, I like scampi.
Yeah, well, I'd look forward to firebombing you with explosive tartar sauce later. Is this, like, basically the way of combating this issue, which I guess isn't, could have been an issue in the pre-internet world with radio and TV and print, but not as much of an issue because you're not living inside such of a bubble, was teach critical thinking. Yeah. But we have to, which doesn't get taught enough in schools, but I guess we have to teach critical thinking for a internet age, which has got a different flavour.
Absolutely. Digital education is very important. But when we talk about critical thinking, you're taught about critical thinking, which is evaluating the data that you have and the thoughts that are around it and logically trying to parse out where biases might be, what might be going on, and to think imaginatively as well of imagine the real reason that might be, you know, again, spurious correlation, ice creams and air conditioning sales. They both spike at exactly the same times. Yeah. Air conditioning sales cause ice cream sales. Obviously not. There's some underlying factor. It's hot weather, right? Yeah. Hot weather. And we can make that imaginative leap and we can say, we'll go and investigate this other thing that we think probably drives these other two things. So you can do that kind of thing with critical thinking. The problem is when you're not exposed to contrarian data, if you are limiting the amount of data that comes in, you have to teach people to go and seek opposing information. You have to seek, and you're teaching people to go against the algorithm. So you've created this algorithm, yeah. And then you have to teach people to try and not use it.
Yeah.
And that's very hard.
How do you get a Daily Mail reader to go and read The Guardian?
Maybe we'll be able to create an algorithm which could like specifically go and reward some adventurousness. I mean, that's genuinely, that's an argument that I put forward quite a lot, that we should be more adventurous and we should be encouraging people to see outside these things.
Yeah.
The difficulty is that at the moment, very little rewards that. There's no real reason to, and increasingly massive corporations are the ones that are making these decisions. There's very little benefit in it.
Yeah, adventurousness doesn't earn money.
Not necessarily. You know, I remember the old joy of browsing through the Argos catalogue of things you were never going to buy. Yeah. And then you might see something that when you're a kid that maybe, that actually looks quite interesting. You'd just be fascinated at the array of lampshades when you gave not a fuck about a single lampshade, right?
Whereas but now Amazon's telling you what you're going
to
buy.
Now you go to Amazon, you try and search for lampshades, and it brings you back to computer games every single time.
To be fair, considering the horrifying picture of the modern world that you have painted, I think I'd quite like to go around with a lampshade on my head at all times.
You want to create an even smaller bubble. I understand. Yeah. See, we are comforted by bubbles.
It'll look great when you get a good idea, though. I really want to talk about Ada Lovelace.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah.
So she published the first algorithm intended to be acted upon by a computer. beyond pure sort of calculation. She, a bit about her, she was the only legitimate child of Lord Byron. The word legitimate's the giveaway in there. Yeah. Apparently he really wanted a boy. He was saying it'll be a beautiful, glorious boy will be born, and was sorely disappointed by Ada's arrival. Her real name's Augusta, by the way. Ada was Byron's nickname for her. And within a month of her birth, he'd separated from her mother, Anna. When she was at the age of 8 when Byron died, and obviously her mother did not think too highly of her father. And so Anna encouraged Ada to study maths and sciences, basically to avoid falling into the trap of her father's love of romanticism and poetics and his insanity, as she described it.
Your dad likes books. Fuck your dad.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. and so, she was fascinated by him. She was really fascinated by Lord Byron for all of her life. She called her line of work poetical science. So she didn't think of herself purely as a scientist or purely as a mathematician, which probably gave her the creative thinking needed to shape Charles Babbage's thoughts. She met Babbage when she was 17. At the age of 12, she'd already written to her mother proposing basically a flying machine. She wrote, proposing a thing in the form of a horse with a steam engine in the inside, so contrived as to move an immense pair of wings fixed on the outside of the horse in such a manner as to carry it up into the air while a person sits on its back. She invented Pegasus.
Yeah, I was about to say, Ada Lovelace.
Steam Pegasus.
I love the thought of steampunk Greek myths.
Yeah, because this preceded cars and bikes and everything that hadn't even thought to like apply to a vehicle like a carriage or anything. Just went, okay, what do people get around on? Horses. Okay, so we need to make a flying horse.
Absolutely. I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. But she met Charles Babbage when she was 17, and Babbage was promoting his Difference Engine, the name of your company.
Absolutely.
And you can probably tell us a bit more what a Difference Engine is. But
it was the physical expression of an algorithm. It was very much like a mechanical thing where you put in the numbers, you selected the calculation or you applied the rule set, and it gave you the numbers out the other side that you wanted.
Yeah.
So Ada Lovelace applied this to the Bernoulli series, I believe, right?
Yes. Yeah.
No, that's the one.
I don't know what Bernoulli numbers are. I tried to read about it and I got a cluster headache. So.
So basically, maths is full of these things where there are a really useful series of numbers that don't actually mean anything in themselves, but turn up again and again in useful circumstances, like pi and e and various number series. The Bernoulli series is one of those, and I'm struggling to remember backwards, but I think they're involved in things like the Taylor series and the Riemann zeta function, which I used to know about but don't anymore.
Great. Well, listeners, there's some homework for you all to go and read a bit more about. But yeah, he was demonstrating the Difference Engine, and Ada was sort of fascinated, but befriended him. And she later translated a paper by an Italian guy called Luigi Menabrea, who was an engineer, and also the future Prime Minister of Italy, who was writing about Babbage, and she translated it. She spoke many languages as an aristocratic young woman, and with her interest in science, she was the obvious person to translate this. But she added her own notes and addenda to this article, so much so that her notes were three times as long as Menabrea's original piece.
Wow.
And she published it in 1843, just under her initials. And note G of all of these notes is the one where she wrote how it could be, you could code the Difference Engine to calculate the Bernoulli numbers, and that's the first algorithm. And she also predicted that computers would be able to act not just on numbers, but on text and on music and on pictures and on sound. So she really did foreshadow what was to come. She was also an incorrigible gambler later in life. She married a guy called William King, later made her first Earl Lovelace, and she pawned his family jewels at one point to pay off a gambling debt. And
could she not develop an algorithm for... Oh, that's where we're going.
She and Babbage apparently exchanged a notebook regularly, and it's thought that maybe they were trying to develop a way of predicting horse racing results. Because she did on one occasion apparently lose £3,200 betting on the Epsom Derby.
I mean, because this is what, the mid-1840s?
She died in 1852, yes.
So hang on, £3,200, that's several hundred thousand pounds
that's
he's
a house.
Lost there.
That's a
lot. Yeah.
It's a couple of houses. She died of, I think, uterine cancer at a relatively young age, in her late 30s. And on her deathbed, a month or two before she died, Charles Dickens came to visit her. He was a good friend of hers. And she requested that he would read her a scene from Dombey and Son on her deathbed. So she read him a scene where six-year-old Paul Dombey dies, which was quite a famous Dickens scene at the time. And despite her mum disapproving heartily of it, she is buried next to her father in the village of Hucknall, so named after the lead singer of Simply Red. I also read about some scary algorithms. My favourite, or least favourite, scary algorithm is the prediction that the US Air Force will develop technology by the year 2047, which will operate on an algorithm whereby drones will be able to decide whether or not to bomb a target. They'd be able to fly themselves, decide whether to bomb a thing, whether it was worth it. The human involvement would simply be what is referred to as on the loop rather than in the loop. They'd be on the outside monitoring the drone's decisions rather than making them for them.
So in terms of making these decisions, does it say about whether it'll make them purely in terms of military strategy, or will it be able to weigh up like the propaganda effects and the political effects?
I have a funny feeling, as Andrew may have said, computers don't have souls. And
No, they don't have souls, but you surely should be able to calculate the way it would affect your polling numbers.
Killing children bad.
One of the biggest things that I end up talking to people about a lot is that we're effectively going to be encoding the trolley problem into a lot of different things. We're going to be trying to teach machines, yeah, like what...
Moral philosophy.
Exactly.
Just for listeners at home, that's the idea that there's a train heading down, yeah, a set of tracks towards a group of five people, and the guy who's running the points has to decide whether to let it hit those five people or divert it so it hits one child off, yep, on another branch.
Exactly.
So it's you kill less people, but you have intervened.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The thing that I think is really interesting is that we extend a whole swathe of like human-based understanding of like, to that person who's making that decision at that point in time, we understand that they're under pressure. We don't blame them too much for stuff. Yeah. But then when you're talking
is
about...
Is the person you're going to divert to a Nazi or a child?
Exactly, right?
What if it's a Nazi child?
But like, and they have a limited amount of time and they're, yeah, stressed and they were out late that night before. Yeah. You know, we make a load of excuses when we kind of talk about these things, especially in like legal frameworks. Then you imagine a situation where you've got a plane that's making a decision whether or not to bomb people based on some model that's been put into the system about like how much a civilian casualty is worth. So like how many civilian casualties is it worth causing to take out Osama bin Laden, for example, yeah, right? Like what is that? And instead of making that decision in the moment, somebody's programming that months and months in advance, yeah, coldly in a room somewhere. Yeah. And that fundamentally changes the way that we feel about it.
Yeah.
And that's super weird.
Yeah, it really is. Well, it's fine. It's 30 years in the future, apparently. So we'll all be dead by then because the planet will have died.
Well, the US has actually already started initiating that program. There's a digital wingman already that's in development where there's a plane which flies alongside you like you're in a computer game. And there's an automatic, like an unmanned combat aerial vehicle,
right,
next to you, flying alongside you and basically copying all of your things and trying to protect you.
I was imagining a digital wingman as a program on your phone that you can get to chat up a pretty person's phone in the bar while you're trying to, you know, pull them.
I was just imagining it was like an AI version of Goose from Top Gun.
I read there is a paper on AI outsmarting itself or its creators, which was released last year. It was called The Surprising Creativity of Digital Evolution, a Collection of Anecdotes from the Evolutionary Computation and Artificial Life Research Communities. And it has some stellar examples. An AI program set up to play five in a row tic-tac-toe, noughts and crosses,
yep,
hit upon a way of automatically winning by requesting moves using very long memory addresses and crashing its opponent. So you'd set it to play another computer, it would just make the computer lose its mind and be awarded a win by default.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the digital equivalent of flipping the board over,
yeah, yeah,
and stamping,
exactly, yeah,
on your little sister's foot.
There was a machine, a simulation set up to try and create a high-jumping creature. It visualised a creature that was a really long, tall pole with a sort of a boxy, slightly humanoid-shaped creature at the top of it. So it was extraordinarily top-heavy, which would fall, and in falling it would flip the boxy human at the top of it, which would cause the pole to invert, so the pole, instead of being on the ground, would flip high up into the air, thereby creating technically a high jump because the pole would point really high up into the air. But it is, when you see the video, just a thing falling over.
That sounds a lot like it learned from famous pole vaulting failures.
Yeah, yeah, it very much did.
Have you seen the other video of it? They programmed in essentially all of the physical characteristics of a human, all of the kind of anatomy and physiognomy, and said basically, given this creature, learn how to walk expending the least energy.
Oh, yes.
And basically, like, the way that we're meant to walk to expend the least energy is that we do this kind of weird stumbling thing and then a little somersault. And
yeah.
then we do a little stumbling thing and then a somersault. And it looks totally bizarre
yeah.
and very painful.
It's very funny. My favorite one of these is they tried to get something, a computer, to figure out a way of landing on an aircraft character while minimizing the force of landing. It was trying to get it to get a really low impact number. And the program eventually hit on the way of doing this by maximizing the force on landing, the exact opposite of what they wanted them to do. But by doing that, it made the variable overflow and flip back to zero. So, again, technically correct. Have you heard of the pancake problem? It was an idea published by a guy called Jacob Goodman in 1975 under the name Harry Dwaiter. Harried Waiter, as you will see soon. Because
that is such a creaking pun.
Well, the premise is there's a waiter in a busy restaurant having to deliver lots of pancakes at once. So he's only got one hand free because he's holding a plate with loads of pancakes stacked on it. The way he wants to serve them is by size order from smallest to largest. And so the question is, with one hand free, the only available option to him and how to sort them is to continually sort of slide a spatula under a portion of the pancakes and flip them and keep flipping portions of the pancakes until you eventually end up with them all in the correct order.
Mm-hmm.
The pancake problem is then, what is the maximum number of flips needed for however many pancakes you've got? They haven't, even 50 years later, hit on an exact formula to hit the how many number of times it'll take it, or any way of expressing it. But there is a further version of the problem called the burnt pancake problem. Obviously, you can apply this to numbers. You've got a lot of data and you want to put it in a correct, in a certain order. The burnt pancake problem means the pancakes are still to be arranged in size order, but also they have a burnt side and a golden side. So not only do they have to be in the right order, but they have to be the right way around as well. And that burnt pancake problem was introduced by Christos Papadimitriou and Bill Gates. Yeah.
Wow.
It's the only mathematical paper of any note that Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft, ever wrote. Actually, in this paper, they were looking at the pancake problem, the basic pancake problem, and they did establish that the maximum number of moves would always be less than 5n plus 5 divided by 3.
Gotcha.
For whatever number, so n being the number of pancakes. They know the maximum number won't ever be above this. Until 2008, that was the closest anyone had gotten. University of Texas researchers have refined that now to 18n over 11. So we're getting closer to the ultimate formula for the pancake problem, but no one's yet got it exact. But another person who wrote an article about the burnt pancake problem was David X. Cohen. Do you know who he is?
He's the producer on The Simpsons.
He is one of the co-founders of Futurama. Mmm, pancakes.
Yeah.
But that's too delicious. And instead, I've gone with the algorithm behind the University of California, Berkeley's joke recommendation site, Jester. So this is a website called Jester. You can visit it. I went on it yesterday to test it out. It shows you a joke written. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are very long-form jokes. There are not many one-liners in it. Then you have a slider that goes from less funny to more funny, so you can position it sort of past halfway or really at an extreme or whatever. After it told me a couple of jokes, it then went, we will now show you jokes based on what we think you will find funny, essentially. And the very first joke I got after it had said, we have now judged what type of joke you like.
Anti-Irish.
No. It was the two hunters in the woods joke.
Which is the best joke of all time.
According to stupid polls.
I mean, it's a Spike Milligan joke. So
It's not bad as jokes go. Yeah, I like the fact that was the recommendation after I got after two jokes, one of which I'd slightly edged to the left.
Uh-huh.
And one of which I'd slightly edged to the right. So it's clearly gone, this is the most middle of the road joke we can possibly tell you.
It's deeply ironic that the most middle of the road joke, therefore, is one written by a manic depressive.
Yes. Yeah, it's very true. It works on a patented algorithm called EigenTaste, which they use to try and understand Amazon's recommendation systems, actually. But there was one joke in the middle of it which I thought was quite apt, that I just thought would maybe good to wrap things up with, which is, how do you get a computer programmer stuck in the shower all day?
Go on.
Give them shampoo labelled rinse, lather, repeat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
There you go.
So, our candidates for the world's worst algorithm are Ben's suggestion of Randy Olson's Where's Wally algorithm, Andrew's suggestion of the Facebook personalization algorithm that is going to doom all of humanity, and my suggestion of Eigentaste, the algorithm behind Berkeley's jester joke recommendation site. Well done, everybody. We've got a good mix of the frivolous and the downright terrifying in there. You know what? Facebook is such low-hanging fruit that, and to be fair, if we badmouth them on the podcast, God knows what's going to happen to the two of us. You may never hear from us again. And I feel like their comeuppance is going to come in a more drastic form than the three of us damning them on the 391st most popular comedy podcast in Qatar. I think we might let them off the hook this time. I really like Eigentaste for just being really shit. The jokes are really poor. Like, all of them, I was like, this slider doesn't go far enough down for how poor many of them are. But we love glorious failure and waste of people's time and money. And I had nearly forgotten Where's Wally was a thing as well. And now you've reminded. And his name is Randy Olson. He's ticking so many boxes for us.
This is an astonishing turn up for the books and proof that real life is better than algorithms.
Yeah, we're living in a bubble where the worst algorithm in the world is not some future-defining, extreme evangelizing Facebook algorithm. It's where a guy pisses around with a children's cartoon book. And that's the world we want to live in.
Yes.
Before you go, I've got some of the world's worst news of the week. This isn't very recent news, but it was it was something I came across in my algorithm studies, so I just thought it would be quite a fun one to read about. A young 6-year-old girl called Brooke Neitzel ordered a $170 doll's house and £4 of cookies using her mum's Alexa. This is in San Diego, and her mum found out about it and complained, and set up some parental controls on the Alexa. But the news reached the local news station, San Diego News CW6, and they had a news report about it. And the news anchor said, oh, I love this little girl saying Alexa ordered me a doll's house. At which point, several Alexas across San Diego heard the order me a doll's house. It's not known quite how many parents had to deal with doll's houses being ordered, but suffice to say there were several complaints to the news station.
It's almost like if I suddenly said, hey Siri, play Never Gonna Give You Up at this point in time.
You're welcome, everybody who's listening to this on an iPhone.
Oh, get in. We just rickrolled all our listeners.
No, I have to big up my team there and say that specifically doesn't happen.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, but now you're denying, you're shaping what we want.
Yeah. and you invited me on this to say about the worst, and then you picked a Where's Wally algorithm.
Yeah, we did. Before we go, Andrew, where can people find out about you and your work and all of that?
People can find out about me and my Apple work absolutely nowhere, because Apple is very secretive about what it's working on. I'm working on a number of very exciting projects, which I'm sure you'll find out about in the future. As for my immersive theatre work, you can find me at www.someevil.com, because nobody can ever spell my surname.
That's with two E's. Just for those of you who are wondering, I did have, Andrew thought it makes it easier if I just call it Some Evil, and then I had to check, have you elided the E's or not?
I have spent so many years doing the opposite of that. I thought I'd pick the right one this around, this time around, and I realised that I'm just engaging in exactly the same problem again and again. It's almost like I have learned nothing.
Meanwhile, we're all off to ask Alexa to order us a pile of Where's Wally books and Nicolas Cage DVDs. Thanks very much for listening to Westford Forward. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, there he is. That's all 67 Where's Wally books completed.
Well, you say that, Ben. We found Wally. We haven't found all of his weird friends that he always has.
Oh, he
with
never
him
made
well.
An algorithm for that.
Yeah, because he has that weird wizard and the red and yellow one and the dog. There's loads of them.
God, there is. Do you think that Randy Olson could adapt his algorithm to finding Maddie?
I don't know. All over Netflix, apparently, is where she is at the moment.
Yes.
as ever, thank you again to Andrew for stepping in last minute and coming and joining us. I feel immensely cleverer after yes. that episode. Like, but in like, Andrew's got so soft-spoken that he was... You know, if he was a Bond villain, he's the sort of Bond villain you wouldn't mind having torture you, because at least you can bear to listen to him while he's doing it.
Yeah, I was getting real... I only learned about this yesterday. ASMR from his voice.
What's ASMR?
I've forgotten what it stands for, but it's basically when you get shivers down your spine from certain sound sensations.
Oh, nice.
It's the sound of, like... I read an article about a woman who makes, like, the sound of going to the hairdresser and records it, and people listen to it, so the snip of scissors or the scoosh of cream that goes on your hair, and people find it very relaxing.
Oh, right. Like rain on the ceiling and not rain on the ceiling, that's a bad sign. Rain on the roof, that's all right.
Yeah, rain on the ceiling, you are in the upside down.
If you want to check us out online, I mean, you already are doing that, but in a different format, then, and if you haven't been completely turned off social media sites, then you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Worst Foot Forward. You can visit us on Twitter at Worst Foot. Ben is on at Ben Van de Velde, and I'm at Baz Max Day. And we have a website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com, where you can find all of our previous episodes.
And you can email us, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. We are very amenable to anyone and everyone suggesting interesting friends and guests on there. But if you want to suggest a topic, then that is very much a Patreon kind of affair. As you heard at the top of this episode, we are always welcome for you bunging us a cheeky little quid or... 7 to keep us in the delightful surroundings of the My Century recording studio that we are currently in.
Mm. With a big shout out to Angie, who's been our sound engineer and recorder and general shouldered cry on for yes. all of these as well, keeping us sounding as mellifluous as we currently are, giving you all ASMR.
Yes. Who are we going to be talking to next week, Mr. McStay?
Next week we have the wonderful Joel and Kyle, hosts of the Absolute Worldie Football Podcast, the football podcast for people who don't really know all that much about football. Joel and Kyle are known to Ben and I as immersive performers and actors and directors. They and
maze masters,
theatre makers and maze masters, but also big football fans. And they started Absolute Worldie as an antidote to the World Cup in 2018, with episodes filling you in on the extracurricular stuff you could learn about Russia and the various teams taking part there as well. So they're going to join us to talk about the world's worst manager. So if you're into football, chances are there'll be a few football managers, but there might be managers from other areas as well. So team meeting in the break room next week, guys. Join us then.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.